From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Athens, Georgia has a problem with partying.
What a shame that a few bad apples have to spoil a good time for everyone by breaking the rules.
Put a sock on it, boy.
Could tighter regulation sober up the town? We'll talk about that and the psychology of binge drinking. First, though, we talked recently in the break room about the difference between the terms Hispanic and Latino. Here's break room regular Hector Fernandez.
Hispanic means, whether you like it or not, you're prioritizing, you're giving more importance to your European descent.
And here are your first thoughts. Gabriela Guardia writes, when I first came to the U.S., I only saw myself as Panamanian or Panamanian American. The terms Hispanic, Latino were forced on me. Many times I chose not to identify with those terms in documents and was mad when I saw them used as a race. For races, I either check all that apply or none. We always love to hear what you think, so call and tell us. The number is 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter. It's at OST Talk, or just post to Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Last week, Georgia's public health commissioner was named as the new head of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention here in Atlanta. Brenda Fitzgerald was chosen by Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price. He's a former Georgia congressman. Fitzgerald is an obstetrician, gynecologist, and two-time Republican candidate for Congress. The last permanent director of the CDC was Tom Frieden. He was appointed by President Obama in 2009. Following President Trump's inauguration in January, Frieden stepped down from the CDC. Frieden joined us to talk about his work with the CDC and what he hopes to see happen there in the future. So let's get the obvious question out of the way, which is where do you go next?
I'm weighing the options right now. What I've always done when deciding what to do next is ask the simple question, how can I do the most good? How can I save the most lives? And that's the question I'll be asking as I decide between the opportunities I'm looking at.
So that's actually has been an essential question every time you headed an agency, because you went from some really innovative work in tuberculosis to be health commissioner for New York. And I wonder how you make those decisions. And this feeds into the CDC's campaign on winnable battles, right? How do you decide what is winnable? What are the sort of components that go into that?
I think of it kind of in a very logical way. You first ask the question, what's killing people or causing disability? Then you ask the question, of those causes, which of them are actually preventable? There's some that we can do a much better job preventing. There are others that we don't yet have the tools to prevent. And then when you have that list of those that are preventable, how do you go about doing it?
So, like an example of one we don't quite have the tools to prevent, car accidents, is that sort of in
there? Oh, actually, we know very well how to reduce motor vehicle fatalities. In fact, that was one of our winnable battles, and we came close to achieving our goal. What we did with winnable battles was to come up with a proactive agenda. Often in government, you're tempted to just deal with the inbox, see what happens, and respond day by day. And we had a pretty busy inbox between Ebola, MERS, Zika, pandemic influenza. But we had a really proactive approach. And that's why, because of the work of CDC, America is safer and healthier today than it was before. Take your example of motor vehicle crashes. There are things that can be done, for example, to reduce the risk that kids will get into crashes with graduated driver licenses. When I grew up, we didn't have those. You had a learner's permit for a while, then you started driving. Now, graduated driver licenses are very effective at reducing the risk. The risks when people start driving are massively higher than risks later in life. Second thing that can be done is reduce the risk of drunk driving. There's been a real understanding that drunk driving is something that is a peril to the public. You don't want your kid to get killed by someone who's intoxicated when he's or she's walking to school in the morning. And there are things that can be done to reduce drunk driving as a cause of motor vehicle crashes. And of course, both the road construction approach and the vehicle safety approaches have made major impacts reducing motor vehicle fatalities.
So one of the criticisms of the winnable battles when the CDC released that was that it didn't include gun deaths. I want to read a question that the CNN posed, and they said, quote, why is the nation's leading public health official a nonstop messaging machine not talking about something that kills more than 30,000 people a year in the U.S.? That's more than the number of Americans who die of AIDS or colon cancer or prostate cancer, more than the number of people who died in the entire international Ebola outbreak. What's the answer to that?
Well, first, CDC does what Congress directs us to do. Congress is essentially the board of directors for CDC. Our budget is very specific and very structured. It's broken down into about 200 different lines, and we do not have freedom to decide what we do. We have freedom to decide how we're going to do it, but Congress determines what we work on. Realistically, we've asked in each of the past years for resources to study gun violence and figure out ways to reduce it as a health issue, and Congress said, no, we don't fund you to do that. However, what we have done is to work with states to expand something called the National Violent Death Reporting System. That gives states the resources and technical input so that they can track every suicide and homicide in the state and understand what the causes were so they can try to prevent it. States have done that, and they've taken actions. For example, Oklahoma, when it looked at its data, saw that many of the homicides were among women who had previously had a domestic violence issue, and therefore they strengthened their approach to domestic violence. In Oregon, they found that there were many suicides among the elderly, so they strengthened suicide prevention measures among the elderly. There is no question that the U.S. is an outlier when it comes to gun deaths, both suicide and homicide. And I would hope that we could develop more information, but also implement the things that we know work to reduce the risk that there will be accidental or suicide or homicide from guns.
So you were just talking about states and also the relationship with Washington, and you'd mentioned to me that the CDC is the largest government agency that's not based in the larger D.C. area. What difference does that make? How does it either help or hurt the CDC to be separate, literally, from Washington?
CDC is the largest federal agency headquartered outside of the Washington, D.C. area. We're here in Georgia. That is our home. We have more than 10,000 staff and contractors working here, a payroll of over $1 billion that leads to about $2 billion in industrial output here in Georgia. We bring in about 150,000 visitors a year to Georgia. We also spend about $1 million a day on purchases for things that we need to keep CDC.
$1 million a day?
To keep CDC running. And we partner for nearly $200 million a year with Georgia universities. So we have a big economic footprint in Georgia. But being in Georgia means two things. First, we are, I hope, a little insulated from some of the issues that
political
swirl
wrangling
around in Washington. However, we're also a little far from where budgets are decided. And that's why it's particularly important that people in Georgia, particularly the elected representatives here, make clear that investing in CDC is a best buy.
Sounds like you're talking straight to David Perdue and Johnny Isaacson.
Well, Senator Isaacson has been wonderful. He's come to CDC many times. He's traveled and seen what we do around the world. He really gets the fact that CDC is good for America. It saves lives, saves money. It's a best buy. Senator Perdue is newer. He's been to CDC, and we look forward to working with him. But also in the House, we need people really making clear that CDC is an investment. We protect America, and if we cut that, we make America less safe.
So you began sort of your high-profile career working with tuberculosis, and your fight against an epidemic of tuberculosis in NYC. People have studied that as a model of how to treat an epidemic, and this really interests me because there is so much personal human chaos involved in fighting disease. How do you efficiently organize a department to fight an epidemic? I mean, I guess that's what people study when they look at that as a model, right?
What I've always try to do is come up with what I call a technical package, a limited number of interventions which, if done well, will result in a specific outcome. In New York City, we made sure to diagnose patients promptly, treat them completely, reduce the risk that they would spread the disease in hospitals, and track the outcomes of every patient. Underlying all of that was one single concept, accountability. We were accountable to the patients for making sure that they got cured. And you're able to do that in TB because you can get close to a 100% cure rate. But we found that patients were dropping out maybe because they were poorly treated, maybe because they had mental health problems, maybe because they had drug-resistant bacteria that weren't effectively treated. We put in a system to track every single patient in the city and ensure that they completed treatment. some people objected to the fact that when people wouldn't take medicine, if nothing else would work, we would put them in a hospital till they were cured. But, you know, as we learn in high school, your right to swing your fist ends at my nose. And so we made sure that we were treating the patient as the VIP of the program. We reached out to homes, even sent people into crack dens to give people medication. But in the end, we very rapidly controlled it and did that through a combination of technical rigor in diagnosis and treatment and human contact, reaching out to patients and making sure that they got the care and treatment that they needed.
Now, you've mentioned one thing that sort of complicates your job in fighting disease, and that's privacy rights. Many people didn't want to be stuck in a hospital bed. But there are other things that complicate it. Then you get culture and society and even religion. And one of the winnable battles, for example, for the CDC was teen pregnancy. And there's all kinds of things that get involved in the battle with teen pregnancy. How does a scientist deal with all that, again, that chaos and mess that is inherently human?
We find that there's really an interplay between laws, regulations, and programs and the cultural norms. Think of the things that have changed in the past few decades in this country, from would you like a cigarette to be polite to do you mind if I smoke to not even asking do you mind if I smoke if you're in most people's houses. That's a cultural change that facilitated and was facilitated by things like smoke-free laws. Or think about drunk driving. It used to be common to say, would you like another drink for the road? Now it's friends don't let friends drink and drive. So that kind of cultural change is important. Teen pregnancy is at the lowest levels ever documented, and that's a combination of things. It is some delay in sexual onset of teenagers and a big increase in access to contraception.
What work do you leave behind? What did you not get to finish at the CDC?
Well, I think CDC can be encouraged by the progress we made in the past 8 years. America is safer and healthier because of the work we did. We have better prepared laboratories, more staff at more places, better tracking systems so we know where things are happening. We stopped threats in this country. We worked around the world so we have a tripwire and we'll understand when threats are arising elsewhere better than before. But there's still much more to be done. We still need to do better helping other countries detect problems there so we can stop them there and don't have to fight them here. We still don't have a rapid response fund so that the next time there's an emergency, we won't have to wait 9 months for Congress to act, but can nip a problem at the bud.
That's referring specifically like Ebola and Zika, where the CDC had that problem.
Zika in particular, but even with Ebola, when Congress acted quickly, we didn't have what are called emergency authorities. So we had to follow the usual government systems, which can take months when we need to take action hours. So a rapid response fund. And then there are health challenges like opiate overdose and antibiotic resistance, where we made a good start, but there's much more to be done. And we should never forget that the leading cause of death in this country is heart attacks and strokes. Most of them are preventable by doing simple things like controlling your blood pressure, not smoking, and getting regular physical activity like taking the stairs or walking.
That was former CDC Director Tom Frieden speaking to me earlier this year. His successor was named last week. It's Georgia Public Health Commissioner Brenda Fitzgerald. Just ahead is Too Much Partying Bringing Athens Down. But first, I talk with one of my musical idols, Amy Ray of the Indigo Girls. This is On Second Thought.
Good night, sweet tender. The veil is on the loom. Coyotes sleep, they sing a lonesome tune.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. One of the most successful and influential groups to come out of Georgia is the Indigo Girls. Since the first release in 1985, the folk rock pair has had multiple platinum albums and won a Grammy. The Indigo Girls will play as a pair in Atlanta in September, but both musicians also perform as solo acts. Here's Amy Ray from her 2001 solo album, Stag.
We were talking ticket slump. We try to put our finger on it. We quantify the undoing of each little step, and it's just a lack of press in the refrigerator down at the boys' club with its little magnets of poetry they found.
Amy performs Friday night at the Variety Playhouse with her group, the Amy Ray Band, and she joins me now from Gainesville, Georgia. Hi there.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. You know, my first question is actually, totally inconsequential and just to satisfy my curiosity, but there's a note in Wikipedia that says, you guys actually lost Best New Artist Grammy to Milli Vanilli. Is that correct?
That is true. We really did. Yeah. It was a long time ago.
Do you ever just look back at that and wonder about the path of fortune?
It was such a scandal at the time, but we remember. I think now it wouldn't be as big of a scandal, but we didn't mind. We actually, the Best New Artist, sometimes that award can be a bit of a curse because it's so much pressure, you know.
Yeah.
So we probably tried to look at it as a blessing in disguise.
How do you? I mean, the Grammy's not the only award you guys have won. How do you view awards like that? Are they helpful for an artist?
Sure. I mean, everything adds, you know, to the well. That's not why we do it, and we don't count on it. But when something like that happens, we're grateful for it, honestly, because it brings new people into the fold, and it's validating in some ways. So, but it's not, you know, the end all and be all of what we're doing.
So tell me a little bit about your songwriting, because I wonder if you, when you're writing a song, how you know whether it's best served as an Indigo Girls song or as an Amy Ray Band song.
Well, in the past it was, I started doing solo music in 2001 because I was writing a lot of punk rock songs, and and I had a lot of friends that were playing punk rock, and I had an indie label, and I was putting out a lot of punk bands, so that was a very obvious differentiation, and it had more to do with who I was going to collaborate with on it. You know, as far as a writer, I'd write the song and I'd be thinking of, this is going to be a great song to play with the Rocketeens or the Butchies or Josephine Wiggs or Kate Schellenbach or, you know, some of my other friends, Joan Jett. And then when I started lately, you know, my last record was country, and it was traditional country and mountain music. And that was a little bit different, because Emily and I, we do write stuff that could cross over into that category. But we've never been in country music, probably mostly because we're so left-wing and we're gay, and it wasn't really a place that where you could find a place in that. It was more like Americana. But I think lately country has opened up a lot too, and to different perspectives and styles. And so what I did, I love traditional country music, and I always have for so long, and I was writing songs in that vein. And I just found some other collaborators that were, you know, like a pedal steel player and a guitar player and a banjo player, people that I really loved. And I was like, you know, I think I found my people that I can make this record with.
Good night, sweet tender. The veil is on the loom. Coyote sleep. Sing a lonesome tune. All my life I'm rambling, and so you're in my stead. I lie awake and wonder at every bedtime tale. So keep those.
I think it's more like when I'm writing a song, if it's an Emily Amy song, Emily's not the same about this, but I really can hear her in my head when I'm writing, and she can be a catalyst for me sometimes, knowing what are the harmony parts that she might write, or the guitar or the banjo or the piano or whatever might go on it that she might do. So that's probably what dictates that. It just gets thrown into that category, and then I work on it in the light of in that kind of, with that lens.
So what is it about country music that you say that you like? What is it about that particular genre that you love?
I love good songwriting, and I love storytelling, and I have to admit, you know, I moved up to Dahlonega about 25 years ago, and being around all those players up there, it definitely got into my blood, you know. And when I was younger, I had listened to country and southern rock, but was writing more in the folk vein. And when I got into Dahlonega, I was like, it just kind of started coming out of me, especially I think the gospel style. I really like old school kind of field recordings from the mountains, and that just, I love that storytelling, and I think that's what it is for me. It's just the storytelling, and you know, country and punk are quite akin to each other, I would say, like Hank Williams and and The Clash have a lot of similarities in their song structure. So it, and it's both, it's very populist, you know, like to me, the beauty of punk rock was that anyone can do it and you just, it's three chords and the truth kind of thing, you know, and that's the beauty of country as well.
Sing full-throated, just you leave it all on the stage. And I mean, I always wonder when I'm hearing you sing, I hear you sing recently and I think, wow, how was she able to sustain that? Like, how can you give it all and then still be singing two decades later? How do you protect your voice?
Oh, it's that the giving it all part is just passion. That's kind of always what I've had on my side, when even when I wasn't really very good at what I was doing. Because I was so passionate about it, I could get away with it. But I just, you know, I actually do a lot of stuff. I have this DVD that I swear by that was made by a vocal instructor named Melissa Cross. It's called The Zen of Screaming. And it was made to teach heavy metal singers how to sing without losing their voice. And it actually changed my life. I started practicing the warm-ups and sort of being a devotee to her about 15 years ago. And or maybe 12, and ever since then, I've taken just much better care of my voice, and I warm up religiously, and I try to sing correctly, and you know, I can still yell and scream and belt it out and croon and do whatever, and it's just doing it the right way to keep me from losing my voice is what I do, and this came about after losing my voice a lot and needing some help and to figure out how to not do that, you know, because I would just lose my voice after three shows because I was just singing incorrectly or just yelling too much, you know, whatever, or talking too much after the show, things like that. So it's a lot of water and a lot of sleep when I'm on the road. And but now I have a 4-year-old, so I'm having to figure out how to what to do in that context, because you know, I sing to her all the time, and so sometimes I'll get onto my first show and I'm hoarse because I've been singing every night. to my baby late at night, you know. So I'm refiguring it out again.
How do you think parenthood has changed you as a musician? Has it changed maybe the sound or what you write about?
You know, it hasn't seeped into my writing quite yet. I'm sure it will. But it focuses you differently. You have to manage your time differently because you have small chunks of time instead of, I don't have 3 hours to sit and write at home, but I might have 30 minutes. You know, or when she was really young and she took a lot of naps, I would just use her nap time to write. Or sometimes I would even have her nap in my studio and just rock the cradle with my foot while I was working on a song. And it worked for about 3 months. And then she got bored, I guess, and wouldn't sleep as much. I think it's like your time, you know, you have to reorganize your time. But for me, it hasn't necessarily come out in my lyrics yet, but it does give you a perspective on the world that's quite different and a little broader, I think, for me anyway, you know, and you know, you meet, obviously, because you have a child, you're meeting other parents and people from different walks of life and have different opinions, and it's really good. It really gets you outside of your bubble, and I think that's really important to hear what other people have to think about things. And so for me, I appreciate that too. You know, I don't try to just hang out with the same kind of person as I am. And having a child really puts you in situations where you're not. So you really have to learn to open up to people and be more social. And I'm a hermit, so it's really forced that for me.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with singer-songwriter Amy Ray. She's best known as one half of the Georgia-based duo Indigo Girls, but Amy performs with her solo band Friday at the Variety Playhouse in Atlanta. So let's talk a little bit about the broader world, because, I mean, one of the things you have been known, you and Emily have been known from the very beginning, is as not just musicians, but activists. That's been a huge part of both your music and what you chose to do in your spare time. And I wonder how that has evolved and how that's looking under the administration of President Trump.
Well, some of our activism has spanned administrations. At this point, we're pretty old, so we've worked during a lot of administrations, and some of it spans through them and isn't, it's affected somewhat by them. But I would take, for instance, like our work with Native American issues. We started a group in the early 90s called Honor the Earth, and we fund Native-run groups that work on environmental and cultural sustainability. Now, that has been something that no matter who's in office, there's a lot of work to be done because those groups are very disenfranchised and very much in sort of invisible to people. So that is an ongoing battle in some ways, but also an ongoing win because some of these tribes are doing great things with alternative energy and developing market, you know, economic bases in their communities that are based on some kind of agricultural sustainability or energy sustainability. And so that work can be a really positive blessing to kind of work outside of the box and work with these, support these tribes that are doing such really a forward-looking work, you know. But as far as, you know, human rights or civil rights or issues we work on, maybe gay issues or issues around immigration, I mean, it's greatly affected by who's the profile of the administration, I should say, you know. And so it just changes the, I mean, I'm a pretty optimistic person, and I'm also pretty optimistic about people. So I tend to just try to reach across the aisle, so to speak, and work with people coming from maybe a different perspective policy-wise, but are just compassionate people, and try to solve problems from that perspective. And I think living in Georgia, you know, for us, we've always kind of gone against the grain politically here, but we've also, it's where we love to be, and it's people that we love. And you find a way, it's really a great place to learn how to dialogue with people that feel differently than you do about things. And I think that that's good, and it's good for us, and it's a good way to build solutions. So I personally, I try not to let whoever is in charge affect me. And it does affect me because you see the dismantling of things that we've worked really hard on. But I also feel like you see opportunities to build bridges and to reach to communities that, you know, may become disenfranchised or are suffering and feel invisible. And I don't know how to, I think I'm just always been that kind of optimistic person. And I've always lived amongst people that, where we have very big differences politically. And so I sort of just figure out how to keep going for the solutions and keep working to improve things. That's where I've always come from, even in my family, where we all felt differently about things.
So, I mean, Georgia is a pretty complicated place, not just politically, but in a lot of ways. I mean, there's a lot of very disparate people here. And I wonder if you hear that reflected in not just your music, but in Georgia music in general. What is the sound, do you think, of music from this state?
It's the sound is like the sound of the dirt for me. It's like even in hip hop, you know, and even in the most poppy music that comes out of Georgia, you can still hear that slow agricultural, you know, sitting on the front porch, talking to your neighbors, heat, sweat. You can hear it in every kind of music. And so I think that's the thread is cultural in some ways. You know, even when you're talking about, you know, burgeoning, you know, Hispanic communities that have music coming out of those communities. And so it's sweat, you know, sweat equity or something. I don't know. But it's and I know a lot it is complex because there's so many different kinds of music. And then you have your like Christian gospel scene and you have like country and it's from every walk of life. And that's the beauty of it. I mean, I love the South. I'm from about four generations have lived here, so, or five actually. So I just feel close to it and I feel a kinship to it. And I can, it's a scene that I can relate to, but you're right. It's complex. It's very complex and it's very different musically. And the great thing about Georgia is Georgia's getting more and more diverse. So I love the state, you know, generally, and I love the South. So for me, it's really exciting. And the music scene is part of it. You know, Georgia music is incredible, and then we have this incredible film and TV industry, and there's a lot of good things happening here.
Singer and songwriter Amy Ray, she's best known as a member of the Georgia-based duo Indigo Girls. Amy performs Friday night at the Variety Playhouse in Atlanta. That show starts at 8 o'clock. Amy, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You too. I love your show. I listen to you all the time. So it's a pleasure to talk to you, actually.
I listen to you all the time.
Oh, really? I'm glad we could get together.
That makes my whole day. Thank you. Have a great
one. No, I do. I'm a GPB freak. So, yeah, I listen to you all the time.
Well, that is awesome to hear. Thank you on many levels. Just ahead, does Athens have a drinking problem? This is On Second Thought.
I'm trying to tell you something about my life. Maybe give me insight between black and white. And the best thing you ever done for me is to help me take my life less seriously. It's only life after all. Yeah. Well, darkness has a hunger that's insatiable. And lightness has a call that's hard to hear.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The University of Georgia in Athens disciplined two fraternities this year. In the spring, Phi Kappa Tau was suspended for a year after underage drinking was discovered during a hazing ritual. A moratorium on new bars opening in downtown Athens took effect in February. And all of this points to a possible problem with partying. I talked about this recently with Dylan Thompson, a senior at UGA and a writer for the Red and Black newspaper. Also joining us was David Lynn, director of planning and outreach for the Athens Downtown Development Authority, and Dr. Nikki Nance, a professor of human services and psychology at Beacon College in Leesburg, Florida. So let me start with you, Dylan. Do you agree that UGA has at least a partying reputation or a partying culture? Would you agree with that?
I would certainly agree with that. I mean, you know, I think when people come here as a freshman, one of the first things they hear is this stat about how there are 80 bars or alcohol selling establishments within a 1 mile radius. And I think people think about an SEC school and football and game days. And I think that image really kind of builds up in your mind, whether it tends to be true or not based on your own college experience. I think a lot of people come in with that expectation.
Dylan, you have been in Athens for how many years?
I've lived here for 3 years now.
So you just came there for college. Now, David, you have been in Athens for much longer than that. When did you arrive?
Well, I arrived as an undergraduate in 1980 and have been in Athens pretty much ever since then.
Was UGA known as a party school back then when you got there?
Oh, certainly. When I first arrived here, the university was celebrating our whatever their status as National Lampoon's number one party school.
Nikki Nance, how does a school become a party school, and does that always mean a partying culture?
I think some schools are thirstier than others, and you know, some of them, and I think especially if you've got, you know, active sports programs and fraternities, you know, those schools are going to get that reputation. And I know that some, I believe that some students are looking for that that kind of school to go to. They want to have a good time while they're in college.
Is there evidence that some universities contribute to the reputation and culture of partying, Nikki, and some universities do not?
I'm not aware of any. I don't think any school wants to. You know, that's not in anybody's promotionals. You know, your kid can drink here, but certainly it's part of a lot of campuses, and I think more some than others. Small town campuses. What I hear from students is there's not really much else to do. I think they'd still do that even if there was a lot else to do, because big schools that I'm a little bit more so associated with before I got there, that were in bigger cities, they had plenty to do, and there was still lots of drinking. But I think some schools really do get that reputation, and I think it's because it really is the culture.
Okay, so Dylan, we actually got a tweet from somebody whose name I can't repeat on the air, who says, when I asked if drinking is a problem in Athens, this person tweeted back, problem or only thing to do. Dylan, is that, do you think part of the problem is that there's not enough to do in Athens?
I think part of the problem is definitely the perception that there's not a lot to do in Athens. You know, I mean, as far as what there actually is to do, Athens has, a ton of restaurants, a vibrant music scene. There are always concerts to be able to go to. There are events put on by the university weekly and every weekend. But I do believe that, you know, a lot of students kind of perceive it that way. I mean, even, you know, as a senior with, you know, friends who I would say aren't necessarily the most inclined towards drinking, a question that I hear a lot on weekends is, you know, are you going out tonight? What are you doing? And that's always the first question. It's not really, what are you doing? It's, are you going to the bars or are you not going to the bars?
So, David, how much of this is tied up in this ban on new bars downtown? Did you support that ban?
Well, that was a moratorium.
Temporary.
A temporary moratorium with a definitive purpose and a definitive sunset that the Athens-Clarke County Commission passed in February, largely in response to public safety concerns on the amount of people in a small space. Some of the focus groups that I've gone to on this issue surrounding the study that the commission has initiated is focusing on ingress and egress for fire concerns and some ancillary behaviors associated with that number of people in a small city block. So I think no one would question that Athens has a vibrant and vital downtown. There's a lot of bars. And this was just an attempt by the commission to have some breathing room and reconsider if there's anything the community needed to do or could do about what's being termed these high occupancy bars, bars that are typically styled towards students and have a large number of people in them over the weekend.
So, David, how do you respond to what Dylan called the perception that there's nothing else to do in Athens but go to a bar or go to a party?
Well, I can't speak to what is attractive to someone who's 18 to 24 years old, but Athens is consistently rated as not only one of the better cities to live in the state, but even in the country. It's a typical college town in many regards. It has a very creative culture and class here. There's always something going on. It's relatively close to Atlanta, so there's opportunities there. I think there's a lot going on in Athens. Now, a lot of those things may not be attractive to the typical 18 to 24-year-old, other than socializing.
Okay, so let me go to you, Nikki, because we're talking about partying, and sometimes that's taken somewhat lightly. People don't, no, I'm not talking about officials, but I mean in general, sometimes people don't take it seriously, whereas oftentimes, especially in colleges, partying ends up resulting in binge drinking, and binge drinking is quite dangerous. What drives that phenomenon of binge drinking?
Well, I guess I'd first like to say that, you know, you've got a perfect storm of new drinkers, you know, or drinkers that are just becoming of age, the first time being unsupervised, and then of course the availability. I think the binging, but you know, part of that is, you know, once you drink anything, the prefrontal lobe is where your judgment kind of comes from, which is underdeveloped until people are about 25 or 26 anyway. But that's, you know, you lose judgment, and so it becomes very difficult to know that you've gotten too much, and you know. Kids drink, if they drink really fast, they don't recognize that because they aren't feeling it immediately, that it's still in their body, and that's how people go all the way even to death from the binge drinking. I think the other thing that is, it's more, probably a lot more prevalent now than when I was in college, or, you know, maybe some other people. So there are a lot more people on medications, on a, you know, for attention deficit disorder, a lot on medications for anxiety disorder. So even binge drinking that wouldn't be risky for somebody that, you know, for somebody else might be more risky for a lot of college students.
We are talking, if you're just joining us, we're talking about the possibility of a problem with partying in the city of Athens. We did invite representatives from UGA's administration to be part of the discussion. They didn't have anyone available, but we're speaking to, you just heard Dr. Nikki Nance, a Beacon College psychology professor, also David Lynn of the Athens Downtown Development Authority, and UGA senior Dylan Thompson. I just wanted to give a couple quick statistics on binge drinking since Nikki brought up the prefrontal lobe. In fact, binge drinkers are 14 times more likely to drive while impaired by alcohol, and even beside the danger to life, which it is quite dangerous. Binge drinking costs the U.S. almost $250 billion in a year's time. The most recent estimates we have on that is from 2010, so I assume they're fairly current. So Dylan, what kind of education do you think students at UGA get? When you get to UGA, do you get, I guess, information about drinking and about partying and the dangers associated?
Yeah, I mean, you do, but I would definitely say that it's something that might be taken kind of a bit lightly at large. Everyone takes a course, I believe it's called Alcohol EDU. It's an online course. And I think it's something that oftentimes kind of gets, you know, laughed off a little bit because it is online and it's mandatory, but it's something that you kind of just breeze through. You're not actually in a classroom. You're not actually hearing this from a person and being held maybe accountable to situations that are specific to Athens, but rather more about problems that are associated simply with binge drinking and some of these statistics like you're talking about in general. So one thing that I definitely think, you know, maybe students could benefit from would be, you know, programs that are, you know, not only held in person and, you know, maybe on campus as a freshman, but also very specific to some of the problems that students in Athens face specifically.
Let me play you a clip, Nikki. This is Beth McMurtry. She's with the Chronicle of Higher Education.
What you see among colleges is that they tend to focus on education as a means for changing students' behavior. This idea that if you give students the right information, that they'll make wiser choices. But the research has shown that education without enforcement and without intervention, without trying to control the flow of alcohol on campus, really has a very limited and a very short-term effect.
So this goes directly back to what Dylan was talking about in terms of this online course, which is informational but not taken seriously. How does one change behavior? That seems to be a very difficult task for a university.
It's difficult to get people to personal, especially at a young age, you know, when they're naturally exploring a lot of things and capable to have a really good time. it's kind of difficult to get them to be internally motivated to make any changes. In my estimation, of course, I work, you know, Beacon College deals with people all who have learning disabilities or, you know, emotional problems, something. So I get to work with this a lot. That if education is from the angle of something personal to them, so when we're educating about anxiety, you know, when you have special groups in school that are support groups or, you know, safe zones for people that are high risk, that's where to start. If I think when you put up the big sign, I'm going to talk to you about alcohol, then you may as well be talking to a box of glazed donuts. They're not listening.
Dylan, do you have ideas? I mean, you suggested a few, but you must have these kind of conversations. Is there something that the university could do and is not doing?
I definitely agree with, you know, this idea that, you know, just talking about it isn't really going to solve anything. And I mean, even to what I said about there being some sort of, you know, in-person class, you know, at the end of the day, students, especially freshmen who have just gotten out of maybe, you know, their parents' house for the first time, are going to do what they want to do. And I definitely think that the university could, you know, maybe learn from some of the things that, you know, students are doing to help, because there are students that are concerned about this problem. For example, there's an organization called Designated Dogs that's offered more than 80,000 free rides home to students from downtown. And I think, you know, that the university could maybe see some of these efforts that students who are closer to the situation are taking and try to develop their own policies that can help people out. Because, you know, while the concept of an organization that drives students home from downtown is acknowledging drinking, it's at least helping the problem as opposed to just telling people, you know, don't do this, which is something that isn't necessarily going to work very well.
That's UGA senior Dylan Thompson. You also heard David Lynn, Director of Planning and Outreach for the Athens Downtown Development Authority, and Beacon College psychology professor Nikki Nance. The city of Athens may also have another problem, discrimination. So says Mocha Jasmine Johnson, president and co-founder of the Athens Anti-Discrimination Movement. That group works to make Athens a more diverse and inclusive community for people of all colors. Johnson brings us this commentary.
We still live in a nation where people are not only judged by the color of their skin, but also by their economic status and appearance as opposed to the content of their character. Since Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his famous speech, "I Have a Dream," there have been many setbacks. Race relations is still an issue, and the fight for civil rights must continue. In December 2016, we established an in-house civil rights council to help people who have experienced discrimination in downtown Athens. We spent months getting input from the community and reviewing the issue in Athens-Clarke County. And now the mayor and commission should consider creating an independent citizens committee, one that will work together with local government to build a dialogue, reduce the discriminatory behavior, and create a more diverse, equitable, and inclusive community in downtown Athens. Discrimination has been a deliberating problem for many people for many years in this community. Our local government must lead the way to establish real communications and equitable opportunities for everyone. Turning a blind eye or deaf ear to discriminatory behavior based on an individual's race, color, sex, sexual orientation, gender identity, religion, national origin, citizenship, age, disability, or pregnancy does not nor should not reflect the values of Athens-Clarke County. When our local government and various people say they want to see a more diverse and welcoming downtown, it would take more than an anti-discrimination ordinance, marches, and festivals to combat the current issues of discrimination within our community. With this in mind, the Athens Anti-Discrimination Movement will continue to build a strong civil rights advocacy program and council, which will advocate for racial and social justice. We will not be afraid to stand up and speak out against discrimination and fight for equal opportunity.
That's Mocha Jasmine Johnson, president and co-founder of the Athens Anti-Discrimination Movement. And that's our show for today, but we always love to hear from you. So tell us if you have any ideas on how to make cities more diverse, more welcoming, and if that's a good thing. Call us at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is at OST Talk. Our show is produced by Sean Powers, Ryan McFadden, and Trevor Young. Our senior producer is Emily Curitan. Our interns are Charles Lucas and Candace Bates. Tanya Ott is our VP of radio, and our engineer is Tyler Morris. Our theme music is Silent Machine by Georgia's own Cat Power. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.